Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Hello and welcome to this On the Record conference call on the Obama administration's new national security strategy. My name is Stuart Patrick. I'm a senior fellow here and director of the International Institutions and Global Governance Program at CFR, where I also write the blog, The Internationalist. I'm going to be presiding over today's session, and you're going to be hearing from two of my colleagues, Ambassador Bob Blackwill, the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy, and Dr. Janine Davidson, who's CFR Senior Fellow for Defense Policy. As you know, Bob has served in numerous senior positions in the U.S. government, including as ambassador to India under the administration of George W. Bush. He's also had many stints in academia, including at Harvard University. Janine, who's with me here in Washington, served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Plans during the first term of the Obama administration. At CFR, Janine writes the blog Defense in Depth, and she just returned today from the Munich Security Conference. This conversation is going to run until about 1:30 p.m. Eastern time. What I'd like to do is to ask a couple of questions each to our speakers and then turn things over promptly to you for your own questions, as well as reactions to what they've said. After the meeting, I want to note also we're going to be posting the audio, and not long after that, the transcript of the event, so your words will be preserved for future generations. Let me begin with Bob. Bob, the national security strategies have always struck me as unwieldy creatures. On the one hand, they're supposed to lay out a coherent vision of the world, as seen from the White House, instill some confidence that the administration knows how to advance these objectives, and really set priorities in terms of U.S. national interests. On the other hand, the drafters have to meet major bureaucratic interests of particular departments and agencies. So what you often end up getting is something that's full of sweeping generalizations on the one hand, but then also has sort of a Christmas tree approach in terms of including everything in terms of the ornaments. You've been a senior official at the NSC. From your perspective, having seen the sausage being made, you know what makes an effective national security strategy and what doesn't. Do you think that the administration in this case has reached the bar in terms of what it needed to accomplish with this document?
Thank you, Stuart. Well, first of all, I think you have it exactly right. I've myself been involved in several of these, and I think it's fair to say nobody looks forward to doing one of these things. Of course, they're congressionally mandated, and therefore administrations have to do it, but it's months and months of bureaucratic negotiation. Any literary elegance of the document is drained away, and in the end, it has many of the characteristics that you describe. Nevertheless, people pay attention to it, witness the call. So in the first instance, I'd say the documents are designed to make the best case for administration foreign policy. In other words, to deflect criticism. And a good example of that is the 100 times the necessity for U.S. leadership is mentioned in this particular document, which, of course, is responding to the leading from behind controversy and so forth. So the political character, I think, dominates all, the White House making its best case. At the same time, I have to say these documents have no operational consequence, I would say. If I can put it like this, I've been in, I suppose, hundreds of meetings in the White House Situation Room on particular crises, issues, problems, and I've never heard anyone say, well, let's see what the national security strategy says we should do about that. So within a month, I confidently say this document will be securely resting in file cabinets around Washington until the publication of the next one, in which case people will pull it out. But I think we can learn some things about Obama foreign policy by examining this text. And let me just tell you briefly, I can go into this in more detail if folks wish, but tell you briefly what I think we learned. First of all, this national security strategy continually stresses the need to set priorities, but sets no priorities in the document. Second, the national security strategy lists many worthy objectives I think we'd all agree on regarding terrorism, ISIL, Russia, and so forth, but provides no strategies to achieve these objectives. If strategy can be defined as the means that we use to get others to do what we want, if we do this, it will maximize the likelihood that they will do that. This national security strategy contains virtually no strategy, no connecting means to ends. Rather, it is essentially an administration vision statement, if I can put it like that, a wish list, disassociated from what is actually happening in the world and how to achieve U.S. foreign policy objectives. Let me give you some examples. What is the administration strategy to help produce an effective and unifying Iraqi government? Nothing in this document about that. To roll back ISIS? Nothing about that. To end the massive killing in Syria? Nothing about that. To compel Russia to withdraw from Ukraine? Nothing about that. To prevent the Afghan Taliban from controlling the Pashtun homeland and more of Afghanistan after total U.S. military withdrawal? Nothing about that. Strategies to confront the growing cyber threats to the United States? Nothing about that. So these objectives are identified, but with no suggestion of how to achieve them.
Bob, can I
let me just make
can I pick?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, Bob, I was gonna say just to play devil's advocate for a minute. You know, in terms of the prioritization, one thing that the Obama administration would presumably say is that, look, there's a world of multiple threats, and it'd be great if we could afford a single focus, or you know, or a doctrine like containment. We don't have that luxury. We have to address all of these issues in terms of Russian aggression in Ukraine, jihadist terrorism, China's rise, yes, but then also climate change, cybersecurity, nuclear proliferation. Is your complaint more that there's a lack of prioritization amongst these different issues, or that, you know, the goals in and of themselves are fine, the plea for international cooperation is fine, rebuilding the different elements of U.S. national power is fine. The problem is really in the execution, implementation, any idea of how we're actually going to get there?
Well, it's certainly the latter, but on the former, I would say, and I agree, there are a variety of challenges that the administration faces. But as we know, who have worked in government or indeed had any responsible job, our most precious asset is time. And they can't spend equal time on each and every one of these. And so that's the point about priorities. And it isn't as if I'm inventing the emphasis on setting priorities. It's throughout this document. But then the document never says, and here are ours. So that's my response. I just want to make a few more quick points, which struck me from reading the document. This administration is the first, I think, since the end of World War II to reject the balance of power concept as the foundation of American national security policy. That broad, strategic, Metternichian term, Kissingerian term, never appears in this document. In 2010, to remind, the previous national security strategy declared that for the first time in history, international affairs were dominated less by geopolitical competition than the need to manage common challenges. Well, tell that to Russia, China, Iran, Syria, ISIL, and so forth. And then finally is the issue of strategic patience. I'm not sure what that means, but it appears in the document. But my question is, what exactly is Obama administration's strategic patience when applied to Iran's nuclear ambitions, ISIL's murderous territorial goals, the civil war in Syria, the war in Afghanistan? Is it possible that while the U.S. is being strategically patient, what advances are the bad actors in the world making? And in that context, and I conclude here, I was struck and perplexed by Susan Rice in her speech at Brookings denouncing alarmism over the various international crises the United States confronts and saying, well, none of these are like Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, and so we should calm down. I really wonder if the administration believes that we should only become alarmed when there's a long and engulfing world war or an enduring U.S. confrontation with a deeply threatening global nuclear competitor. For example, I don't know what the White House press spokesman would say if asked, did the 9/11 attacks represent an existential threat to the United States, or the 1973 Middle East War, or Iran's acquisition of nuclear weapons, or the detonation of a nuclear weapon in an American city? Are those not existential threats to the United States, potential or real? So I think we learn some things about how President Obama sees the world. I don't think it's very different than he saw it. Perhaps this is unsurprising. When he ran for office in 2008, I don't think it's very different from what he saw, what he thought, as exemplified in the 2010 National Security Strategy. And one can then make one's own judgment about the quality of those thoughts and about their relationship with the actual challenge the United States faces in the international arena in the period ahead.
Thank you very much, Bob. I'm going to turn now to Janine Davidson. Janine, can you provide some of your own insights as to whether or not you think there's a coherent theme in this document? It may not be an Obama doctrine, but it seems to me that there are some themes that run throughout. Are there elements here that you see that critics might have missed? And also, you know, as I mentioned, you served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense during the first term of the Obama administration. Do you detect, in light of the events of the last 6 years, that there's been some change, or do you see more continuity here with the previous national security strategy and the policy pursued over the last 6 years in this document?
Sure. Well, let me start, actually, to sort of pivot off of what Bob was saying in defense of the hapless people that toil in the White House who have to write these things in any administration. It's really hard. Grand strategy with ends, ways, and means, the kind of thing that they teach in war college, is really military strategy aimed at defeating a primary enemy. And this national security strategy is never going to be something like that. So this sort of nostalgia over, like, why can't we get something like containment, I think also misremembers the great debates we had about that at the time, and, you know, what sort of one primary threat would anybody pick if you were that hapless person who had to write this document? The Bush administration chose the global war on terror and sort of ignored other things like the rising China and just about everything else, and they were criticized for that. So you really, it's really a difficult task, as Dr. Blackwell pointed out. Those are valid questions, and I think that it is a valid criticism that there is a lack of, you know, priorities, even though throughout the document they talk about the need to prioritize, and that's a little bit problematic. But to your question about a coherent theme, yes, I actually think there is a coherent theme. I think it is about leadership in the new era and what they're trying to do that I actually kind of identify with is this idea that that there is a need for American leadership in the world, but the way in which America needs to lead, has to be different than it has in the past. I think it reflects the realization that security challenges from ISIS, Ukraine, Russia, China, even climate change, terrorism, the threat of WMD proliferation, even cybercrime, all these kinds of things that we're facing today, don't necessarily lend themselves to unilateral action, even if it's American unilateral action. That said, America is not just one other actor on the stage. They have an outside influence. And by the way, I think this is also where the document rejects the idea of American decline, claiming that it is still the most powerful and wealthy country on earth. So what that provides is an opportunity for America to lead in a way that catalyzes multilateral action to address these kinds of challenges. The United States has something that nobody else really has in the degree that they have it, which is a convening authority. As we see over and over again, when the United States shows up and points the way, people follow. And when they sit back and wring their hands or turn their back, people don't move. So I think what this document is doing is sort of codifying the philosophy that we've been seeing over the last 6 years, and promoting the need to catalyze multilateral action on these issues. And this, I want to make an important point here. I don't think that this is just about burden sharing. Okay, it isn't just like we're tired and we can't do it all on our own. It is actually recognizing that this unilateral bit for the vast majority of problems just doesn't work in the short term or the long term, whether it's climate, cyber terrorism, or anything else. So, yeah.
Yeah, Janine, I wanted to just pick up. Can you give us a sense from your Pentagon experience whether or not Bob's right in a sense that, look, this thing is going to immediately go on the shelf, it's going to gather dust, nobody's going to pay any attention to it. You know, in theory, the national security strategy is supposed to be the capstone within DOD, for instance. It would shape the national defense strategy and the QDDR. Does it play a useful role in providing high-level guidance at DOD and other agencies?
Yeah, I think the answer is yes and no. I mean, it depends on whether you're a savvy bureaucratic actor or not. I think that what the national security strategy does is it provides a detailed roadmap, or not a very detailed, but a roadmap or a framework. It's sort of more of an overarching philosophy. We used to say in the Pentagon, it provides you the stars to steer by. You know, there's people that are looking for specific strategies on every little thing. Go look at the specific strategies on those things. You're not going to see them in the national security document. It's just impossible to do all that. But what savvy bureaucrats do, what we tried to do when we were trying to be savvy, was to look for the priorities and the hooks that are listed in the document. So I'll give you two examples. In the 2010 document, there was an emphasis made on mass atrocities and the importance of preventing and responding to mass atrocities. So back in the Pentagon, we got to work, and we said, listen, the president cares about this, and actually it reflects an arc of change. And I think that the combatant commanders needed to get serious about what does it mean to prevent a genocide militarily or respond to one militarily. And so working on CONOPS and such like that, concepts of operations and plans, real scenarios, so that you would be able to provide the president with options. Another example was the Asia rebalance. That was clearly a priority in the 2010 document, and the Pentagon clearly got to work on trying to articulate what that meant, what was the military element. And when you look at it, what you see is this philosophy that I just described of multilateral action applied to the rebalance. So we look throughout the region and we say, where are the nodes in the system where the American military can have a catalyzing effect on change? Where can they galvanize multilateral action on the problems in the region, and how does that work? And so that's what you see. You see military exercises. You see people or Marines in Australia, and those things are sort of designed with that in mind. So I think that it's easy to say national security strategies are only, you know, grad students get to look at them, but if you're savvy, you'll use the document in order to figure out what you should be doing when you're in the government, and people do that.
Thank you very much, Janine. At this stage, I know that there's undoubtedly tons of questions out there from members of the media, so what I'd like to do is now turn things over to the journalists. I'd ask the questioners to try to be brief and to the point so we can get to as many of you as possible.
Thank you, sir. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key, that is star one, on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star two. Again, that is star one for questions. Our first question comes from Gio Nye from Voice of Vietnamese Americans.
My first question has to do with the Asia rebalance. From what Janine has said, would you say that it is continually be the first priority for the next 2 years? Because I was there when Susan Rice delivered the national security strategy, and she hardly touched on it, even though she did bring it in a little bit. So would you define the balance at this moment in time, and where can we expect the U.S. and China relationship to be in the next 2 years?
Bob, you want to?
I don't know which one of us is meant to respond to that, but I'll just do it quickly. I don't think, and if we're just talking, as I guess we should be, only about the national security document, there is no hint in the document to where the Asian pivot rebalance stands in the list of administration priorities. It is mentioned, for sure, rather in passing, in fact, but in any case, so if this is a star to guide by, I'm afraid it's a cloudy night. And the same goes for China, in which the administration says, we want to cooperate, but we're ready to deal with Chinese misbehavior. So I'm afraid, too, that doesn't give you a guiding star to the next couple of years of the development of the U.S.-China relationship.
Janine?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that Bob's right that it's not massively highlighted in this document, that's for sure. I think what they're trying to do, especially on the China piece, is not actively make them out to be an enemy. And what you see China alluded to but not actively called out on things. So when you think about the philosophy that the administration is trying to promote, which is rules-based global order, U.S. leadership in support of a rules-based global order, and then they go on to mention things explicitly like, oh, let's talk about cyber, and let's talk about air and maritime security and cooperation, and let's talk about space. Those, to me, are actively, they're talking about China. I mean, they must be, because that's where China is providing the most challenge. And so I think you see it there. I think it is an interesting choice not to sort of highlight the rebalance as much as they did in the last document, but it also goes to what we were talking about before. They sort of actively avoided, you know, making one thing the overarching thing. They're trying to say, look, you know, what are you going to give up? If you're focused only on Asia, then what about the Middle East? If you're focused only on crisis of the day, then you're not focused on the long-term strategy. So I think what you see is a long-term focus on the Asia Pacific, which is going to hopefully go well beyond the next 2 years of this administration.
Thank you. Let's go to the next
question. Could I just say, George Bundy once famously said, if you guard your toothbrushes and your diamonds with equal vigilance, you're probably going to lose an equal number of each.
So they need need to set priorities. Next caller, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Doyle McManus from Los Angeles Times.
Hi, it's Doyle McManus. Thank you both for doing this. I'm going to actually pose two quite different questions. First, as Bob pointed out, it's certainly the case that the document and especially the fact sheet they handed out to promote it emphasizes the word leadership. We are leading, but the subsequent comments from Susan Rice and then the president in his Vox interview seem to focus more on restraint, humility, strategic patience. The president said we can't solve problems, we can just improve them. So is there still an unresolved tension here in what American leadership means and what it can accomplish? That's a big question. A second question, as Janine noted, there's a lot of interesting language in here. There's a whole chapter about rules-based international order. What did you see there? Is that did that strike you as innovative in any sense?
Janine, you want to take the first
crack at Sure, I mean, I think that this gets to sort of my major critique of the document, and that is that While I sort of sympathize with the overarching approach that is American leadership in multilateral forum in support of a global order, you know, that will promote stability and security, the problem is in the implementation and in the execution. And there's two challenges to this. I mean, one challenge is the nature of the problems are complex. I mean, so it's hard to do this stuff. And what I think they mean by strategic patience, for instance, is that these problems take time to solve, and that these short-term cheap coats of paint strategies, like, you know, invading Iraq or Afghanistan without a long-term vision, become folly. And so they're recognizing this and saying, you know, we need to take long-term approaches on the one hand. On the other hand, in order to lead in a multilateral preventive way requires that you are willing and understand that you need to use all tools in the shed, to include the military tool. And so, you know, you have to have a willingness to engage all these things in order for prevention and deterrence to work. So on the one hand, they have a focus on prevention and deterrence and American leadership. But then on the other hand, demonstrated sort of unwillingness to want to use the military instrument for fear that it's going to make things worse. And so, you know, or to get engaged early on. And what that ends up happening, like in the case of ISIS or Ukraine, is, you know, windows of opportunity can close. Or facts on the ground change, and then by the time you do engage, it's harder. And, you know, this isn't just an Obama administration thing. This is a perennial problem of the United States to come into things late, and it's a perennial problem of democracies in general. So my point is, if you're going to make it a primary, you know, focus on prevention and multilateral engagement and leading up front, we need to really rethink how we do manage to get in early and do these sorts of things.
Bob, your reaction?
I think, can I just say, Doyle, responding to your question, I think there remains a deep ambivalence within the administration at the top about the exercise of American power. And as Janine just said, I think it stems from a worry of proceeding into a deep swamp from which you have a hard time getting out. But that produces great caution and care about actions. And I believe it's noteworthy that although leadership is mentioned 100 times, there's no section which says, here are some 5 good examples of American leadership. So it's an abstraction. Here's how American power was used successfully. So it's an abstraction which isn't connected to actual administration behavior. Hopefully, to conclude, they have learned something since the controversy about leading from behind and so forth at the White House, and hopefully they are more willing to be active in organizing coalitions to defend and support American national interests. But I think there's a deep ambivalence on the part of the president about that exercise of power.
Let me just add one more thing there. I think that one of the things that did sort of strike me reading through the document is this emphasis on engagement in U.S. leadership. It just sort of feels more activist than it has in the past. And so to the extent that these sorts of documents are a projection of intent, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if we can critique the words versus deeds as we go forward in the next 2 years, or whether there's something to watch for here. Does this project a willingness to shift, to be less the reluctant sheriff, or not?
Could I also just chime in here to Doyle's very interesting question? I think to some degree this plea for restraint and the language of a rules-based international order are somewhat related, because I think one of the theses that the administration is operating on is that in a world of constraints in which U.S. power is not unlimited and, in effect, not always effective in terms of its hard edge in getting good results, and the president is quite explicit about that in his preface, trying to bolster this rules-based international order and trying to share some of the burden is going to be increasingly a part of American leadership. The document also, I think, interestingly makes the point that
The Western liberal order, although it doesn't use precisely those terms, is in fact a resilient one. And it makes the point that with a few exceptions, most of the countries in the world share this desire for a rules-based international order. So the question is, how does one try to manage that process? And although Bob is right that it's not a particularly geopolitical document, there is some emphasis in this final chapter, if you will, on international order. Most of it is about regional order. And there's it's interesting to see the theses about U.S. relations with China, again, very much a let's integrate China into this system, a bit of continuity from something Bob is quite familiar with, which is the responsible stakeholder language of the George W. Bush administration. On the other hand, with Russia, I think there's been some sobering since the first administration, since the first national security strategy, where there's a recognition that, look, Russia needs to be it really needs to be deterred, and this is at least explicit. Well, we can debate whether or not the policy is being effective, but that it needs to be resisted in terms of its aggression, which are undermining major norms of international relations. And then there's also something that probably is congenial to in Bob's viewpoint, which given his experience in India, which is a real sense that we have a potential relationship with India that has quite a deal of upside that we haven't yet realized. It hasn't realized its full potential yet. So there are some geopolitical aspects of this document. Let's go now to the next caller.
Thanks. Our next question comes from James Reynolds from Middle East Eye.
Hi there, this is James Reynolds. Thank you so much for your briefing today.
Thank you, James.
I've got a question about Iran's nuclear program and the talks over it. We're obviously coming to a crunch point. Next month, we've got Netanyahu's address before Congress. And of course, there are efforts to derail Obama's ability to reach an accord at the end of next month. Is there anything in the national security strategy that can inform us on any of this?
No.
Yeah, I'll go on and say, though,
I think I've said earlier that I could see, at least myself, no strategy on the part of the administration in the document, or indeed in general, with respect to the many issues that we've been discussing. I think Iran's nuclear program is an exception to that. I believe the administration is implementing a design strategy toward Iran to coerce Iran into agreeing to stop and indeed roll back its nuclear weapons programs. Whether that is a good strategy or a bad strategy, or whether it'll work or won't work, is another matter. But I think it's exceptional with respect to the administration's approach to Iran, and separates it from most of the other issues we've been discussing, and we'll see whether it will work.
Jane?
Yeah, I actually would agree with that. I mean, there's a whole paragraph devoted to Iran under the weapons of mass destruction category, and I think that's about as detailed as you're going to see in a national security strategy. And so I think we need to stay tuned to see if their strategy is going to play out, and that's going to happen in the next month or so, right, or 2 months, I think. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you again. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one at this time. Our next question comes from Denise Cambina from Boston Globe.
Hi, this is Sanasi Kambanis from the Boston Globe. I wanted to know, it seems like you guys are echoing a pretty widely held view that this administration doesn't really like to have a strategy and tends to wing it or respond to events as they come up. And I'm curious if when you look out at the regional realignments in the world or at any of the major crises like Ukraine and ISIS, if you can pinpoint tangible consequences where other important actors simply don't know how to read what to expect from the U.S. because the U.S. has done such a poor job of telegraphing what its priorities, what its sort of strategic goals are.
Well, I think that takes us beyond the national security strategy, but I'll just quickly say if you go to Riyadh and ask the Saudis what is the direction of American policy, especially with respect to Iran, I don't think you'll get a very definitive answer. I spend quite a lot of time in Asia, and there is a constant question among our Asian friends about U.S.-China policy and so forth. So, and I don't think, perhaps tying your good question to the document itself, I don't think that the Saudis or the Indians or even, say, the Germans, Angela Merkel was just in Washington, will read this document and say, oh, good, now I'm reassured that the administration knows what it's doing.
Yeah, I would agree. This is Janine. I would agree that the national security strategy doesn't necessarily, this is sort of beyond that on the question. Although what I will say in response to your question is that disagreeing with an approach or a strategy is not the same as saying that there isn't a strategy. A lot of times people say there is no strategy when really they just don't necessarily agree with the approach that's being taken. And I think that's definitely what you see with respect to Saudi Arabia and Iran. And in Asia, I think that's what you see. We have both the hawks and the doves across the region and in the United States sort of unsatisfied. You know, the hawks won't be satisfied unless we're setting the theater for war, and the doves are not going to be satisfied because they think that anything we talk about is going to be provocative. And so I think that you need to identify whether people are just dissatisfied with the approach or whether there really is no approach.
Great. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Paul Richard from Los Angeles Times.
Hi. I'd like to have both of the speakers talk a bit about where they see Obama in his caution, in his idea of strategic patience, where they see him fitting in with other post-war presidents. Are there others who've really followed this path, or is he pretty much alone in the direction he's gone here?
Well, let me chime in. I think that he is following a distinctly different approach to American foreign policy than his predecessors. And I think part of that is history, the two long wars that we're just emerging from, and the effect of those wars on the American people. So I think that. I think the enormous transitions that are occurring in the global order and so forth. I also think, though, it arises from his deep conviction of the need to reform America. So I think another way to talk about or think about strategic restraint or patience is to say, I'm not going to act today because I have different priorities. And I understand that the more active I am internationally, the more I may get into situations which will deflect me from reforming America. And I don't think that is a I'm not putting aside whether the virtues, merits, or problems with that proposition, but I think that's quite different from his predecessors. I don't think any of his predecessors would have thought about the world in that way. And let me just say one last thing. I think it's a canard to say, as some do, well, he wants to use the alliance system and American partners to avoid acting unilaterally and so forth. Every American president has wanted to do that. I think Madeleine Albright once said, we'll act with others when we can and alone when we must. And that notion is in this national security strategy, and it's in every national security strategy. And every American president seeks to form coalitions in order to assist the defense of American national interests. There are no exceptions. They don't wake up in the morning and say, I'd really like to do this alone.
Sometimes they must, but certainly the preference is not to do it alone. So I think he's in the same category as the rest of them on that score. But what separates him, I think, is this restraint, what he calls patience. It is trying to avoid acting in the world in ways that deflect America from what he thinks is this existential challenge to reform it, to make it more equal and just and fair society.
Janine here. I have a little bit of a different take on the strategic patience thing, and I'm a little bit sort of surprised that that has become sort of the tagline. I don't see it as a message that administration wants to retreat, drain itself, or look for excuses not to engage. I actually see it as demonstrating, and it gets reported throughout the document, of lessons learned, that these challenges do not lend themselves to quick fixes, that you can't just shock and awe your way through a war and come home and everything's good, that actually if you're going to get engaged, you better think through what comes next, and then you're going to have, and if you actually want to get engaged, and you, the American people, are going to have some strategic patience while we play this strategy out. And I think that's sort of so I see a sort of a lesson learned there in the strategic patience piece, not a reluctance or a restraint or a retrenchment or anything like that. So that's one element. The other element, I agree with Bob, this unilateral versus multilateral thing. The Clinton administration and George Bush Sr. were very, very keen on multilateral cooperation. They had especially George Bush Sr., an emphasis on global order and the need to sustain global order. And at the Munich conference the other day, you had Vice President Biden actually saying, reminding people that this global order that we've enjoyed for the last, 70 years is not a natural set point. It's not something that, that it actually has to be actively managed. And I think that's not necessarily out of sync with other presidents. I would say, though, that George W. Bush might have been a bit of an outlier in that respect, in terms of the balance of multilateral versus unilateral.
Can I just chime in here for a second, Ms. Stewart? I think it's also an interesting question. I don't have an answer for it, but whether or not the national security strategy resonates with elites, the message, if not the strategy itself, because obviously it's not going to be really for broad public consumption, one question is whether or not this focus on domestic concerns that Bob alluded to, the resistance of overreach, which both of you have talked about, and the desire to share burdens is actually something that's quite in keeping with where the U.S. public is in broad terms today, notwithstanding obviously a lot of dissatisfaction with news in different parts of the world, not least Ukraine and the Middle East. But let's go to the next call.
Could I just, Stuart, just a
sure.
two-liner, though, back to this, what you just said in this theme. American leadership, of course, is crucial, and it's throughout the document. But as the late, great Dick Neustadt pointed out, American leadership begins at home. So try to think of the last time that the president spoke to the American people about Afghanistan. So I think one of the reasons, at least in my judgment, that there's this great reluctance in the polling, at least, on the part of the American people about American action in the world is, I think that's congenital with the American people until an American president persuades them otherwise.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks. That's a great observation. Let's go to the next caller now.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rakhilda Durgam from Al-Hayata.
Yeah, hello. This is Rakhilda Durgam of Al-Hayata. I'd like to address the question to Bob Blackwell first and then to Janine. So can we go back to this issue of impact and consequences of a lack of strategy when it comes to the war on ISIS, given
that members of the coalition complain that there is no strategy, afraid that the de facto situation will lead to rehabilitating Bashar al-Assad, and therefore there are real cracks in that. How do you see this happening, the fact of the lack of strategy? Would it lead to more escalation on the ground, maybe, not only in, on air, or is it going to fall apart and we don't know who are the winners or losers? And secondly, on the issue of Iran, I noted, Bob, you said that the exception is the nuclear part of the policy, that there is a strategy towards Iran when it comes to the nuclear issue. Could you elaborate a little more to see how do you feel, where do you feel we are at now? Have the parameters been fulfilled in effect? Have they been completed, rather? And where do you feel we're going from here, given that the partners, again, in the Gulf, are more concerned about the regional ambitions of Iran rather than the nuclear satisfaction of Iran? Thank you.
Well, I'll start, as you asked. I think the first question is especially pertinent and powerful. If your closest partners don't believe that you have a strategy, either your communication is awful or you don't have one. And if these are smart people as they are, it's probably that you don't have one. And I don't think it's just that they disagree with the one you have. I think they think you don't have one. And I don't think they will be reassured out in that part of the world by the national security strategy. If you talk about ISIL, there's no suggestion in the document of how we are going to degrade and then defeat ISIL. And without that, I think you will continue to have what you aptly described as a feeling out in the Middle East that the administration has no strategy. On Iran, I want to try if I can, I have my own views about this, but to stick to the document itself. Since I do think that the administration has a strategy and has had a consistent strategy toward Iran as it sought to deal with Iran's nuclear weapons programs, I regret that they did not choose to put that strategy into the document because it's explicitly discussed in every backgrounder and so forth, and I think on the record that they do of what they're trying to do. But you certainly get no hint about it from the document itself. I want to say one last thing. As you all can tell, I'm able to restrain my admiration for this particular text. But I do want to say something quite positive about it, and that is its call for bipartisan foreign policy. I think it's repeated several times in the document. I think it's extremely important. The United States is paralyzed in major ways when we don't have it, and we don't have it now. And so I really do commend the administration for saying how important it is, and now again back to strategy, it will, and a point Janine made earlier about leading indicators, let's hope that they have a strategy in the White House for actually accomplishing, I know it takes two parties, but for actually accomplishing a more bipartisan foreign policy.
But Bob, could I pick up on that very interesting point that you just made about bipartisanship? I was struck by that too. That it's mentioned several times in the document, in the poisonous, often just incredibly acrimonious political climate that we have here, particularly and then complicated, obviously, in many ways by the outcome of the November elections. Are there elements of the national security strategy when you think of the different areas that are particularly ripe for bipartisan cooperation? Are there some that really spring to mind, either in the economic realm or the defense realm?
Well, if that's directed at me, and then Janine can and speak about this, especially on the defense side. But what I would say is that it's difficult to know until there's a quality of communication between the administration and the Republicans in the Congress. Now, and I'll reinforce something Janine said earlier, I think the Republican complaint about the Iran strategy, the Iran policy of the administration, as Janine said earlier in a more general way, is not a complaint that the administration has no strategy. It is a complaint that it doesn't agree with the strategy, and one can do the merits of the case. But it's those kinds of conversations. For example, let me just give you, I think operationally, so I'll respond like this. The Cuban initiative, I think, was very damaging to the proposition of bipartisanship. When the administration carries out a secret negotiation, doesn't inform the Congress, which learns about it when it's announced, that is a recipe for poison. Whatever the president and whatever the leadership of the Congress. But I wish the president would get the leadership, and Eisenhower did this, Johnson did it, Bill Clinton did it, actually George W. Bush did it a couple of times, and of course Papa Bush did it frequently, is to get the leadership up of the Congress up and say, what are we going to do about ISIL? Now, Eisenhower, if I may just say this, Eisenhower did this frequently, and after every one of these meetings with the leadership of the Congress, he said, I'll never do it again. What a worthless waste of my time. But still, it is a precursor to building enough trust and communication between the two branches to at least aim toward a bipartisan foreign policy.
Thanks so much, Bob, particularly for the historical perspective on that. Janine, your reflections on potential areas to overcoming partisan gridlock on some of, at least some of the president's agendas outlined in the national security strategy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was struck by the mentioning the need for bipartisan agreement. I mean, you can't do anything. I would say you can't do a lot as a president without bipartisan support from the Hill. That said, you can do more in foreign policy than you could in domestic policy. So, but it doesn't always go over that well, as Bob just pointed out. I think a couple areas that, you know, both sides agree that sequestration is just a bad road, and you're not going to be able to have an activist foreign policy as they're trying to lay out here. You're not going to be able to engage the military for prevention unless you get the Hill on board with funding the kinds of things that you need to do that, which is, you know, military capabilities and posture and basic numbers. I mean, I think that there's sort of less partisan debate on things like Ukraine than there is just debate. It doesn't necessarily fall along partisan lines, and I think that you're kind of increasingly seeing that on ISIL, too. These are just complex problems, and people have differences of opinion, and they're not necessarily partisan. But other than that, I would agree with what Bob said in terms of let's hope this is a projection of intent and that we can see both sides coming to the table a little bit more in the last 2 years.
Yeah, one final thing that I'd like to mention, this is Stuart here. As a potential area for bipartisan cooperation, and one, in fact, that the Obama administration is going to depend on, given the domestic political dynamics of the issue, is obviously the area of trade. The document makes quite a mention of both TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and both of those will require a significant bipartisan outreach, given again the constituency that forms the base of President Obama's own party. Let's go now to the question, which may be
if we have time, we'll take another one, but we have about 5 minutes left. So let's go to the last question and take it from there.
Yes, sir. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star one. Our last question comes from Sandra Irwin from National Defense Magazine.
Hi, thank you so much. I was wondering if any of you would like to maybe speculate how these themes in the national security strategy might reshape the military strategy. A lot of people are saying that the 2012 strategy and the QDR have been overtaken by events, and that this idea that we can just downsize the ground forces, we're never going to have a big ground war. And these ideas are not going to work in the future. So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on possibly a rethinking of the military strategy, and despite all the concerns that we see in the administration about being very cautious about the use of military power. Thank you.
I was going to pass this to Janine. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that there's some consistency on the defense side between the national security strategy and, if not the 2012 strategy, the 2014 quadrennial defense review. And what the administration, I think, would say is that these are all very resource-informed and they're aligned with the budget. And I think that that's generally true. I think your point, however, is actually a little bit different, and that is whether that's the right approach, right? So, I mean, I do think you see the language in the national security strategy supporting the language in the 2014 strategy. If this is the way we are going to approach the world, then it all still sort of works. Now, whether you agree that that's the right approach and that you think that cutting ground forces especially, which is one of the criticisms, is what the military would say takes too much risk, that's a different question. And so, you know, as we go forward and we come down out of Afghanistan this time next year, it'll be interesting to see whether that approach works. But right now, I still see the administration on course and on speed on those fronts and aligned with the 2014 QDR.
I'd now like to give both of our speakers just a chance to mention anything that they feel hasn't come up, or anything that they'd like to say by way of concluding observations, if anything. Ambassador Blackwell, why don't we start with you?
Well, I probably, to quote Oscar Wilde, already said more than I know, but I'll just end with one last thought, which is the administration. I'm back to the priority issue and the strategy issue. I'm not reassured on either category by this document. And if I can say with some confidence, if the administration doesn't, at least internally, if it wasn't willing to do so in this document, establish clear priorities of its objectives in the last 2 years in office, and if it doesn't develop refined strategies to accomplish those objectives, then I'm afraid we're going to have a very rough 2 years in the last period of the Obama presidency.
Janine here. I think that I would agree with you on the need for refined strategies. That I don't necessarily think that you were going to see them in any national security strategy anyway. I think that's a little bit too much detail. So I think that's one thing. And the need for setting some priorities, I think we're going to continue to debate that. The administration basically took a sort of a bold approach in saying, you know what, it's really hard. We have to juggle these things all at the same time. So I think those are problematic for the administration, but it also maybe uncomfortably reflects the reality of the global challenges that they're facing. So I think overall I would say that the philosophy that they lay out is is fairly sound, and I think that they do a good job of explaining the way in which they intend to exercise American leadership in the world vis-a-vis the challenges that they see. I think that you see more continuity than change in this national security strategy. You still see those same values that you've seen in every national security strategy since about 1950 with respect to, you know, support for democracy, rule of law, global order, human rights. I do think you see one shift. It has adapted to, I mean, the approach to Russia, for instance. I mean, the reset is definitely dead. And so the way in which they operationalize or refine their strategy towards Russia, I think, is going to be something to watch for very soon, and definitely over the next 2 years. So I think the biggest challenge I see is not necessarily in the overall approach and philosophy, but in the operationalization and the execution of that approach per specific challenges, whether it's Ukraine, ISIS. We haven't really talked that much about the threat of terrorism, but there's a lot of challenges there with this approach. And so I think that's what we'll see going forward.
Well, I want to thank both of our panelists for their candid reflections on the strengths and weaknesses of the document and the dilemmas and hurdles in bringing some of these ideas into operation, whatever one's judgment about their wisdom. It's now incumbent on me to bring this to a close. I want to remind everyone that this was an on-the-record event and that we're going to be posting the audio as well as transcript on CFR.org. Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.